Let me ask you, what's the best use of suffering? I imagine every one of you here have suffered some in your life. Have you gotten the best use out of it? Have you gotten the best mileage out of your suffering? I was interested in this because I was reading over in 2 Corinthians. Paul said, I glory in my suffering because it will help me to encourage you in your suffering. Now, when we look at our suffering and say, I'm going through this that I might help somebody else who's going through it, then it gives a purpose, the ultimate purpose for suffering. I got a call one afternoon from a CEO of a big board company, a man who's gotten an awful lot of ink. In his late 30s, he was CEO of a large corporation. And people don't really know him, but he has some real emotional problems. And I met him several years ago, and we've just stayed in contact. And he called me and he said, Fred, I'm having panic attacks. He said, I start into a meeting, and I can't open the door, and I have to turn around and go home. So I can't make myself go into the meeting. I'm having these, so I think I'll die. So I started describing the feelings. Your breath's coming short, heart's palpitating, can't concentrate. He said, how do you know that? I said, 30 years ago, for 2 solid years, I had panic attacks so severe I couldn't even talk on the telephone. I had no idea that after I came through those panic attacks, 30 years later, that some young man would call me and tell me about panic attacks. So I just went through what I did to get out of these. And he said, you know, we've just bought a big home in Colorado Springs, but we can't move, and my family doesn't understand why. I can't get in the car. So he called me a few days later, and he said, Fred, we're in Colorado Springs. I said, how'd you make it? He said, I wrote your name and number on a piece of paper and stuck it in my pocket. And I thought, if I have an attack, I'll call Fred. And said, we made it. There was no attack. I went through the things I had to go through with for 2 solid years. Unbelievable. The doctor told me, he said, you're going to have to stop these adrenaline storms. You're going to get killed. And they were rough. Would you ever thought that 30 years later, I would have a use for those things? And now, he is pulling out of his, just through the same things that I found worked. In our Sunday school class, we have one of the vice presidents of Trammell Crow Company, and his young son, 6 years old, John Mark, died. And they took their ranch and turned it into a camp for young boys. This past year, 1,100 disadvantaged boys have been in that camp. They took their suffering and they passed on the good of it. Two of my friends who had teenagers to die met. They established a fund, and they started meetings for young men because they wanted their life of their young men to keep going. And it was this way, through their suffering and their death, that other people could have life. You know, when you look at suffering, you look at the music, the art, the literature, without suffering, we would be very much impoverished in our whole culture. Look at the songs, Amazing Grace. That was written by a man who was a slave, a white man who became a slave in the African trading. And out of that wretchedness, he found the Lord. Amazing grace that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. without the experience, we'd have never had Amazing Grace. Or you take the song, There's Within My Heart a Melody. You know the history of that? This preacher was off holding a revival. His home burned, his wife and his children. He got on the train to go back home to the funeral. And he said to God, unless you give me a song, I can never sing again. Before he got off the train, he had written, There's within my heart a melody, Jesus whispers sweet and low. Fear not, I am with thee. Peace be still in all of life's ebb and flow. Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. The real story is in that other verse. Though sometimes he leads through waters deep, trials fall across the way, though sometimes the path seems rough and steep, see his footprints all the way. And out of his suffering, we have one of the great Christian hymns. There are many others. Oh, love that will not let me go. This young man was engaged to be married. He found he's going to be blind. He went to his fiance, and he said, I find that I'm going to be blind. And she said, I can't marry a man and live with a blind man all my life. And so they broke the engagement. And he wrote, Oh, love that will not let me go. I yield my flickering torch to thee. I give thee back the light I owe, that in thy light. And so he wrote, Oh, love that will not let me go. One of the great songs is Leave It There. Do you know the song? Leave It There, Leave It There. During the worst times of in the South, this man almost starved to death. And he became sick. And he wrote, Leave it there. Take your burden to the Lord and leave it there. When your body suffers pain and your health you can't regain and your soul is almost sinking in despair, he will never leave you then. He'll go with you to the end. Take your burden to the Lord and leave it there. One of the great songs. When you look around and you see people who are suffering things that you have suffered, are you sharing with them? Do you take it as your responsibility to help those people? A friend of mine came to me, CEO of a major New York company. Came to me the other day and he said, Fred, I can't lead a Bible study. I can't lead a prayer service. But I can run a corporation. He said, Do you know any young men that I can help? You know, that's what to me it's all about. He wanted to start to mentor people in corporate life. One of the things we make a mistake in is we compartmentalize our life. We come out here and we talk about the Christian, but we don't talk about the business. It seems to me that we should amalgamate the secular and the sacred and make it all one thing. I'm always happy when somebody says to me, I can't tell whether you're talking business or religion. I think that's when you're talking right, is when you blend the two. And he was doing this. When you look around, what about the unappreciated people? Mary Alice and I have been very conscious of the older women who are working now as waitresses. We say to each other, she isn't here because she wants to be. She's here because she has to be. Went in Owens the other day to test out their hot cakes. You've got to know those kind of things about a civilization. And this older woman, it was early in the morning, this older woman was so kind and gracious and upbeat. And I almost didn't say anything to her. And I said to myself, she isn't here because she wants to be. She's here because she's got to be. And I just said to her, you know, you are better than the hotcakes. I wanted her when she went home that night and took off those shoes off of those tired feet. I wanted to tell her family, it's a tough job, but at least one fat guy came in and appreciated what I was doing. I think we've all been unappreciated at times, and the appreciation of people. What about the lonely? Our daughter went through a divorce. I don't think you really understand loneliness until you understand rejection. Do you see people who are lonely? They need you. Do you see people that are abused? I was interested in watching the Racial Alger program. And this little black girl got one of the awards. She couldn't have been over 14 or 15. And she said, I'm an abused child, but I got to make it because I got a brother and sister who are younger. And I got to say to them, you can do it. She's using her suffering. What about the disadvantaged? Kay James came to Dallas to speak at the prayer breakfast. Wonderful lawyer, government official, delightful lady. She was talking to a group of feminists. And she asked them, she said, what if you were a mother of four children, living on welfare, living in a project, found out you were pregnant and your husband walked off and let you, what would you do? And they all said, have an abortion. Kay said, I'm glad my mother didn't feel that way because I'm the child she was pregnant with. And now she's an outstanding lawyer. What about the depressed? There's a lot of depression, particularly in the ministry. Through my columns in leadership, I'm in contact with about 150,000 preachers. Tremendous depression. I think there are many reasons for it. I think we may have things set up to where that they're under pressures that they're not supposed to be. I think they've set it up for themselves in some respect. I think they've taken on some responsibilities to be CEOs instead of pastors. And a lot of them are not equipped to be that. I went to a conference on the church in the 21st century. And wonderful lectures. But they are the same lectures I would have heard at the American Management Association. They were talking about CEO. They were not talking about pastor. Big difference. I got a letter from a woman preacher. And she said, when I was 12 years old, I saw my father murdered in front of me. I went into shock. I attempted suicide 3 times. I've been in 3 mental institutions. But I found the Lord, and now I'm preaching. And so we corresponded. And then I got a letter of distress. She said, Fred, I'm in a blue funk. I've had to quit preaching. I'm afraid I'm going into a black one, which meant suicide. So I immediately wrote her. Then she wrote me a wonderful letter. She said, Fred, I don't have to be a famous preacher, do I? I don't have to be a well-known Christian, do I? I can just be an ordinary Christian. She said, I saw in the newspaper where a little girl had gotten into prostitution and dope. It was in the jail, and I went down and I said to her, how you doing? She said, I'm doing all right, very defiantly. And she said, I'm glad, but I just want you to know, if you need a friend, I'll be your friend. Said the little girl just dropped her arms and started screaming, just crying. Came over and they just stood there hugging each other and crying. She never preached a more eloquent sermon in her whole life than that. And then she put a little P.S. on it. Fred, I hope to meet you in this life, but I probably won't. But in heaven, a girl will come up behind you and tap you on the shoulder and say, I'm Elizabeth, but my friends call me Ginger. I look forward to meeting Ginger, who just decided she could be an ordinary Christian. This past week, I was at the board meeting of Christianity Today. I've been on the board now for 18 years, and we have some great people on there, great theologians, great ministers, great leaders. Ozzie Hoffman, you know, the voice of the Lutheran hour. Boy, when he walks in the room, it's a benediction. He leaves something in the plaster just by being there. We have Jay Kessler, you know, the president of Taylor, former president of Youth for Christ. Alan Emery, chairman of Billy Graham's ministry and a great industrialist. We just could go around the table. And we got to talking about religious leaders who have fallen. And I'd been thinking about it. You know, I have a feeling about when religious leaders fall. They fall when the power stops coming through them and starts coming from them. You know, as long as you realize that you have to have God's power coming through you, He'll use you. But after you start having results and you start to think the power comes from me and not through me, this is the time that we collapse. You meet the guilty people, many guilty people. I noticed last night your weightlifter, Paul Wren, talking about he couldn't get rid of the guilt. I was speaking at Chuck Swindoll's church, Fullerton. A little tight-wound girl came up to me and crying and wanted to talk. And we talked over the phone because I didn't have a chance to talk to them. You know, incidentally, I have found that I can talk to people over the phone probably better than I can in person. You remember Freud had them lay down on the couch? That wasn't because he didn't want them to see him sleeping. That was so that they wouldn't have eye contact and they could become isolated and let it all just boil out of them and he could overhear what they were saying. I find the telephone is very useful for this. And she called me and she was crying and I don't believe I have a right to be involved in anybody's trouble without permission. And so I didn't say, "Why are you crying?" I said, "Do you want to tell me why you're crying?" And she said, "Yes." Said, "I came here 5 years ago from another country. I was a happy Christian. Now I'm involved with a married man, and I cry all the time." And after we talked a little bit, I said to her, and I believe in being honest with people when you are talking to them. I said, "My dear, if you quit him, the pain ain't going to go away immediately." I said, "I would think you'd hurt for 2 years at least. I mean, this old idea, you know, give your heart to Jesus and to pray the prayer and everything just turned right around. That isn't the way I find life. And I can't recommend that to other people. It may happen, but generally it doesn't happen." And I just said, "You know, for 2 years you're going to hurt. But you're going to hurt with hope. And if you don't give him up, you're going to hurt without hope." And she said, "Let me get a pencil." So she got a pencil and she wrote down, "Hurt with hope." And she said then, she didn't speak the English well, but she said to me, "Can I ever be white again?" She meant clean. And then I told her, "You know, though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be as snow." Clean. That's the gospel we preach. That is what the truth is. And it helped her, the guilty. The unloved. Spent a day not long ago with Millard Fuller, you know, the man who, Habitat for Humanity. Can you believe they are now going into their 30,000th building? 30,000 homes? Do you know the story of Millard Bennett? Oh, man, I should have brought the tape. I tell you, he's the best stand-up comedian I've listened to. This guy, he is some kind of a funny guy when he tells about his life story. See, he went into school, and he and a buddy in school formed a partnership to get rich. And I mean they wanted to get rich in a hurry. And they said, "Okay, we can't sing and we can't play ball. So we got to be salesmen. And we got to sell something for a lot of money. It costs very little." So they put out a direct mailing program on selling mistletoe, because mistletoe was all in those trees down there at Auburn where he was. And he found out they couldn't get it out of the trees. So, but he started me. He's just a natural born promoter and a touch of con man. And now it's dedicated, and there's nothing better, you know, than a con man, you know, that's dedicated it. I mean, you know, that really works. And he started out, and he just got filthy rich. He said he couldn't afford to graduate because he was making so much money off the students that he couldn't leave school. But so he set up a little office there in the school. And a wife walked off and left him. And he says the world just crashed around him. And so he went to New York where she was. And they spent 3 days just talking about getting back together. And he said to her, "I've just been consumed with getting rich. Making money is all I've ever thought about. I made a mistake. Now what we're going to do, we're going to give away everything we got, including the car. Everything. And going to start over again." She said, "I'll buy that." They gave away everything they had. Went down to a little farm, Cornelia Farm, outside of Americus, Georgia, and started over again. And it was just two, three couples. One of them was a PhD in New Testament. And he ran the farm, always wore overalls. And he said, Millard said, he learned his theology, milking a cow. The PhD would sit on the other side and pull on two of them, and he'd sit on this side and pull on two of them, and said they talked theology under the cow's tail. And this is where he learned theology. And then he just started saying, "I want to do something with my life." And he looked around and saw there were a lot of black people there and living in shanties. So he just talked people into the town, donating some stuff and helping out, and they just built a little plain, simple house. And then he got President Carter involved, and then he got everybody involved in it, you know. And the guy's worldwide right now. It's just an absolutely wonderful story of what one guy can do. I had never met him before, and he's a very close friend of our son's. And when he met Mary Alice and me, he just said, "Gotta hug you. I mean, this is for your boy." That's a pretty good pay for being a parent. That's when it pays off. He just went out to help the unloved. What about the immobilized? I see people who are absolutely immobilized. I was lecturing on a college campus and I got a letter from a young fellow. Very sad letter. And he closed it by saying, "Until I hear from you, I'll be floating around." A lot of people floating around. I was talking to a girl the other day. She's got too much money. Doesn't have to work. Floating. How do you give these kind of people direction? Our friend Joe's vice president of human services or human resources of Motorola has a marvelous career planning program, which he does for senior executives. And I sat in on it. I felt a little foolish at 79 planning a career. Particularly when we got down to the last where it said specifics for 5 years. Well, I wrote the number one thing was stay alive. And then when it went to the 10-year program, I said complete the 5-year program because it takes me twice as long now to do anything. But I was doing this because I have these young people that I'm trying to work with, and it's just a wonderful program of career planning for those people who are immobilized, who are just floating around. What about the hopeless? Suicide's a result of hopelessness. I loved what Angel said last night. Can you imagine a better name for a preacher's wife than Angel and a last name of Smith? I mean, that has to do something for you. I like when she said hope replaces dope. Something has to replace hopelessness. What about the physically handicapped? I was speaking at the prayer breakfast in Wichita, Kansas. Afterwards, one of the executives there said to me, I'd like for you to see one of our plants. Well, I want you to know, after 50 years in business, I have seen about all the plants I wanted to see. And I couldn't get out of it. And he said, I really want you to see it. I said, I'm chairman of the company. And I want you to see it. I said, what's so unique? He said, we only use Down syndrome employees. I think some 200 to 250 Down syndrome people. So I went out there. I'll never forget what the superintendent said to me as I started through. He said, Mr. Smith, remember, these people can see right through you. See, they've lost their hostility. And they're loving, and they just see right through you. Well, as we walked through the plant, they'd come up and hug you. They just, you know, just so loving. And I said to him, I said, this is something pretty good. How much time do you spend out? He said, I come out nearly every day. I said, you spend a lot of your own time without pay. He said, yeah. He said, I'm chairman. We got nearly to the end of the plant. I was talking to one of the supervisors, and this little girl came up, and she hugged him. They all had. And then she hugged me. And then he said, Fred, I want you to meet our only child, Lynn. See? Instead of becoming bitter, he'd become better. And he'd used his suffering in a constructive way. This last one. And this one just to make you think. When Paul talks about his thorn in the flesh, what's he talking about? You know, you've heard people say it was his poor eyesight. You've heard him say he was short. You heard him say all these kind of things. Did you ever really think through what his thorn in the flesh was? It was a spiritual thing. Because it said it was a messenger of Satan. Could it have been a spiritual doubt that he fought with all of his life? See, you never think about Paul doubting. What if he did doubt? He'd be a messenger of Satan. Well, why didn't God take it away from him? He asked three times, take it away from him. He said, my grace is sufficient. I want you to live every day hurting because I want you to know my grace. What if he had a temptation that he never was able to overcome? He never yielded to it, but he never could overcome the temptation. See, that would be a thorn in the flesh. You know, poor eyesight, things like this, that's not that great. See, Mary Alice was in the hospital this time last Saturday. She'll get over that. This is something that Paul wasn't going to get over. This was going to be with him for the rest of his life so that he could experience the grace of God. Can I give you the four principles I see in how we utilize our suffering? First is we own our experience. If you've had suffering, own it, admit it. It's yours. You can't deny it. You can't transfer it. See, I never got to go to college a day in my life except to lecture there. And I think I've lectured in about 26 universities. It gives me a little pressure with the teachers. They do have a feeling about it. They used to have me to do a lot of commencement addresses, and they finally gave me a couple of honorary PhDs so I wouldn't be so ignorant. didn't change me, but it made them feel better. First time they put that velvet around my neck, I felt like an Edson. Just own your experience. Many times when I was talking to top management of American Management Association, and I'd mentioned not having a college education, some guy'd sneak up to me and say, boy, I'm so glad to hear you say that. I said, wait a minute, I didn't say I didn't have an education. I said I didn't have a degree. Big difference. Disgrace not to have an education. No disgrace not to have a degree. Just own your suffering. Second, understand it. Most of our suffering is not punishment at all. Nothing has happened to you that isn't common to man. I had breakfast with the J.I. Packer last Thursday morning. One of the truly great theologians, I think, from England. And we were talking about it, and I said, you know, J.I., so many people want to be God's spoiled brat. They don't want to have to suffer at all. They want to go through life free and easy. That's being a spoiled brat. In his nice English way, he said, may I steal that? Oh, I said, absolutely, I'd be honored. Third thing, own it, understand it, develop a plan for it. See, the only way we get out of this amorphous feeling is to have a specific plan. And a plan does this for you. It concentrates your thinking. It coagulates your thinking. Second, it gives you a basis of hope. I have a friend in Dallas who's in chapter 11. It's been very rough until he got a plan. And now he has a plan for coming out of chapter 11. And he's got hope. Before that, it was hopeless. The third thing it does, it gives you a measure for your progress. Without a plan, you can't measure progress. The fourth is this, and that's the willingness to share. I see people who don't want to admit their mistakes, don't want to admit their suffering. It doesn't hurt me to say I came up on the other side of the tracks. I can identify with people. People will come up and talk to you about it. Or to tell them that, you know, I haven't used that right hand since I was 3 years old. That's handicapped. There's nothing wrong with that. But you just simply own it, understand it, develop a plan for it, and then have a willingness to share with others. Let me ask you, have you found a use for your suffering? It's the best use of it you can have. Paul said, I glory in it because my suffering will help me to help you to bear your suffering. And we share each other's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. Thank you very much.